miles of freeway construction. We had 1,100 miles of freeway construction between 1960 and 1980. That went down to 385 miles from 81 to 2000, and 200 miles from 2000 to 2020. I am pleased to state, however, that I think the governor's transportation proposal that we unveiled about 2 weeks ago is a very strong step in correcting the underfunding of both transit and transportation over the years. This is another illustration of the impact of congestion. We estimate the citizens wasted a total of $54 million in congestion in 2002, the equivalent of 6,200 years. That's a long time stuck in traffic. This equals $740 in lost time and fuel for each traveler in the peak period, an overall cost to this region of almost $8 billion. This data is from the Texas Transportation Institute. I believe strongly, you know, people always try to say, Peter, are you a roads guy or are you a transit guy? The fact of the matter is we've got to push the envelope in all directions. I believe it's not singularly about roads, though I do think we need more roads and we need more bridges. It's not all about transit, and I'm very mindful of the huge costs of transit and the huge subsidies that transit requires. We are keenly aware of that fact at the Met Council. I think it really requires, however, at the end of the day, a multimodal solution, and it does go to the heart of our competitiveness as a region. Our focus in our transportation plan, again, the document that was passed in December, is to focus as specifically as we can on congestion mitigation. Accelerate critical highway expansion where possible, expand express commuter bus service where practical, and we have the different tiers for our transit ways. In other words, we have prioritized them. The Northwest BRT is one. We released $20 million that was in the previous bonding bill, and we were able to find our way clear to release that $20 million. The North Star Commuter Rail, in the governor's bill, bonding bill, it's $37.5 million. You all will be taking that up in short order. The Cedar Avenue BRT and the I-35 BRT is something we're also strongly supportive of, as we are the Central Corridor, though we have not made a determination on the Central Corridor of what mode of transit, BRT or rail, would be pursued. In addition, and very quickly in the interest of time, our regional transit system, there are a number of components. It should be noted about 25% of our transit operations are outsourced. We operate with Met Council employees, 75% outsourced, about 25%. We are the region's largest transit provider. We're the 11th largest transit provider in North America. We have 12 cities in our opt-out system. This happened in the mid-90s. They run their own transit system. Much of it is express bus into the two downtowns. We have contracted regular route services as well for areas that we don't think it is efficient for us to provide that service. We provide metro mobility services as well. This is a much-needed service for persons with various forms of disabilities. We have dial-a-ride programs in rural and suburban communities where we think regular route service is not efficient, and van pool programs in areas without regular route transit service. Some of those are in conjunction with the private sector. You can see transit ridership. This slide causes me some degree of heartburn. We have in our policy plan to double ridership by 2030 and to grow it by 50% by 2020. To be blunt, we're going in the wrong direction. You can see in 1996, we had 65 million riders, and in 2004, though that was a strike year, as you all are painfully aware, we had a 44-day strike. It was the longest strike in U.S. Transit history, something I say with more regret than anything else, but that did have a huge impact on our transit ridership. In calendar year 05, we are looking at about 70 million riders, just a little bit north of 70 million riders throughout our whole system. But that's a far cry from doubling our ridership, and I'll remind you of that line on that slide I showed a little while ago of the vehicle miles traveled going straight up. I see transit as a piece of the puzzle, but we need to get our ridership numbers going in the other direction. Revenues, we have about $309 million for our entire a transit system yearly. Fares are 76 million, or about 25%. The federal government, through various programs, are about 9%. We get 21.5% of the motor vehicle sales tax. That is, as you all know, a big part of the governor's proposal. He would transfer 100% of the motor vehicle sales tax starting in fiscal year 08, and it would grow, it would be 100% after a 5-year period of time, starting in fiscal year 08. We get 21.5% of that now. That's at $134 million. That's 43% of our transit budget. And the general fund provides $57 million, or 18%. And you can see where those dollars go. In the interest of time, I won't go through it. The Metro Transit with 69% is the 10,000-pound gorilla and takes the largest share. Our subsidies, this is always a question. When I went to the Met Council, people said, Peter, there's a good news, bad news story. We have one of the most efficient transit systems in the country is the good news. The bad news is it needs a 70% subsidy. That's just a huge amount of money. And there's no way of glossing over that. This is one way of looking at it, is what is the subsidy per capita? So if you look at Seattle or Portland or Pittsburgh, the subsidy that that region provides to their transit system, Seattle is $225 per person, Portland 170, and so on. The peer average is 109, and we're at 76. So while there are huge subsidies that we are providing to our transit system, we have to be mindful and concerned about this being the taxpayers' money. It is comparatively less than the peer reference group we've identified. The next slide is another way of looking at this, and this is the fare box recovery rate. The fare box recovery rate, the difference between the 25% and the 28% that you see here is this is Metro Transit. That was all of our transit services, is 25%. When you isolate where we collect fares, which is in our, we don't do it uniformly across all of them, we are at 28.8%. That's a relatively high fare box recovery rate. To me, it is still, in a comparative sense, the long and short of it is this. In a comparative sense, we run a very efficient system. In an absolute sense, we got to do better. It's just not good enough. Overview, as I mentioned, we're looking at a little bit more than 71 million rides we're projecting in 05. We're down about 4% from strike level still. Metro Transit provides 93% of the region's transit ridership. We have over 851 buses, 24 rail cars. We have 135 routes. We're always, incidentally, restructuring our routes to maximize efficiency. We just restructured one in South Minneapolis. I said the Met Council has about 36, we were budget of about $600 million and about 3,500 employees. Half of our budget is Metro Transit. And you can see, two-thirds of our employees are Metro Transit. We've got 3,500 employees, 2,600 of them are Metro Transit. And as I mentioned earlier, it's the 11th largest transit system in North America. You've heard that we purchased 3 more rail cars. That brings us to 24. We had 21 prior to that. We have 120 employees in our rail operations, which also might be of interest. 82% of our trips are for work and school. 40% of the people in downtown Minneapolis use transit. It's an important point. 61% have cars but choose transit. That's an important point. We don't see transit. I think people will always have cars. What we would like to get is people to make intelligent choices of when they use their car and when they use transit. 36% have household incomes above $50,000. The point here is transit is often seen as a program for the indigent, and it certainly is more than that. And by and large, our customers are happy with the services that we provide them. We work closely with employers. 103 employers have enrolled in our MetroPass program. 388 in our transit works programs. These employers sell transit passes in the workplace. They pass on, and they often discount it. And we just entered into a new agreement with the University of Minnesota for our U-Pass program as well. Accomplishments, probably the largest is opening up the Hiawatha light rail line. I think, again, even to those that were critics of the light rail line would need to acknowledge that the line has performed much better than many people would have initially thought or anticipated. Our ridership is 100% over projections, and that is something that we're very, very pleased with. We restructured bus service in the South Central area, impacting 50% of our ridership. That restructuring is often the difficult but necessary process to increase or to continue to increase the efficiency of our system. We implemented we purchased some hybrid buses, 3 now, but we're going to be doing 20 by 2008. This is part of a governor's initiative on air quality, and we are now purchasing ultra-low sulfur fuel. We were just purchasing low sulfur fuel, and now we're purchasing ultra low sulfur fuel. And actually, when we negotiated this, I was fearful that it was going to be more expensive. We actually got it cheaper. The cost of fuel, however, as an aside, is a very real issue. And we provide over 800,000 state fair rides. 27% of the people who go to the state fair, myself included, take the bus there. And it's important to note this is not subsidized. Quick word on Hiawatha, 12 miles, 17 stations. This is, to cut to the chase, was one of the most successful openings of a light rail line, according to the FTA, across the United States. One of the most successful. Completed 27 days early. We were fully operational December 4th. We carried almost 3 million customers in 2004, and as I mentioned, it's over 100% over what our projections were. And we debated, or there was a debate, actually before I got there, about it's on the honor system. That has raised a few eyebrows. The compliance ratio is quite high. 2000 fare compliance is at 99.7%. Over 700,000 customers were checked for fares. 600 citations were given. 1,200 warnings issued. The whole question here is your fee collection mechanism cost more than the fees that you collect? And I think clearly we are in good shape here. Regional parks, let me go through that. That's a less known area of our responsibility. We have planning responsibility for regional parks. We do not have operational responsibility. And that's an important thing to understand. In 1974, the Metropolitan Parks Act was adopted. It authorized the council to prepare a regional recreational and open space policy plan, which identified land that cities, counties, and special park districts should acquire and develop for outdoor recreational purposes. And that primarily is what our planning responsibility does. We create this policy plan. We approve master plans of the park districts. One of the things, we prepare and partially finance park capital improvement programs. So if you have a park in Minneapolis or in Eagan or any place in the seven county region, and they want to acquire a piece of land, that has to be part of their master or our park planning process, and we really do this jointly with the 10 implementing agencies, and then we help finance the acquisition of that land. We issue bonds as a match to state and other funds. Essentially, the state provides money, we issue bonds, and the parks themselves also participate. And we provide pass-through funding for portions of their operating budget. I believe it's $3.3 million that we provide as a part of their operations. The rest of the park operations are through local property taxes that they raise. We have 52 million acres. That's up from 31,000. And incidentally, let me just a word about this. This is, transportation is my personal number one priority at the Met Council. The second one is parks. Here again, across the political spectrum, everybody likes parks. Everybody thinks that we need parks. And if we're going to accommodate the growth of a million people in this region over the next 30 years, we got to have a place for them to recreate. We have 46 regional parks and park reserves, 6 special recreational features, 22 regional trails, and it has over 30 million visitors per year. Quickly, here's where the parks are. I won't spend much time on that. You'll have that for your perusal later. Here's a listing of those implementing agencies. You can see where they are, and again, we do a master plan with them, we fund a land acquisition, and we help fund their operating budgets. Here is where the dollars come from. 59%, you can see the visitors, 59%, these are the visitors, the 30 million visitors. This is an important point. 59 are local, and those are persons who recreate in a regional park located in the same county or city or where they live. So there's always a question of who's using them, because that should inform who pays for them. 59% of people who recreate in one of these parks lives in that county or that city. 34% are persons who recreate in a regional park outside the county or city where they live, but they're from the region. 3% are from live outside the metro area in greater Minnesota, and 4% are from outside of Minnesota altogether. We're developing our policy plan there, and you can see what the schedule is. The bottom line is it'll be, we're going to have public hearings in April and hope to adopt it in June. I'm coming to the end, folks. Here's our sources overall, calendar year 2005. You can see our budget is over $627 million, and you can see where the sources come. Our water charges from the state, this is for all of our operations that I've just described. Passenger fares, local and others, property taxes, do have taxing authority, the federal government, and use of reserves. All total, that's $627 million. And the use of the funds for the entire council, you can see where the use of the funds go as well. I will be open to questions for that, but will not elaborate. The council, one of the things we've done is reduce the number of staff. And you can see it was at 3,800 in 01, and it's at 3,600 in 05. And I think we need to continue to be vigilant on that. We have made a commitment to keep property taxes flat. We have done that for the past 2 years. That is also something that I believe very strongly in, and that we have been able to maintain. And finally, I would like to extend an invitation to all of you to come to the State of the Region talk. It'll be this Monday, July 31st, at the Earl Brown Center in Brooklyn Center at 10 a.m. And I think there's an invitation in your packets. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be glad to welcome any comments or questions.
Thank you, Chairman Well. Any questions? We have Representative Gruffalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chairman Bell. Just first a testimonial. I live down in Farmington, and you know, whenever we go to Minneapolis now, whether we're going to a Twins game or going down to the Holidazzle Parade or go to the Monster Truck Rally, we family usually takes the train now because it's cheaper than driving and it's quicker than driving. So. Good job on that. I guess I do have a couple questions about it, some things I'm concerned about. Regarding Hiawatha, number one, I think everyone agrees the ridership numbers are way over expectations. However, do you have any concerns that this might be just based on the novelty of it, that, you know, this is, you know, it's a new thing that's kind of a thrill ride that people are taking? That'd be the first question. The second part of it, the operating budget for the line, how's it doing? Do you have any concerns there? And then, Mr. Chairman, if I have some other questions, if possible. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the first question to the novelty factor, I suspect that there is some of that, that is a part of it. As you know, we opened up the line in two phases. Phase one, that went to Fort Snelling, was opened in June, and then in December, December 4th, we opened up the second phase. And so we'll have to see. I think that with it being at 106% of what we projected, that even if it slides back somewhat, it'll still be significantly over projections. Quite candidly, I think the majority of the public has weighed in on the Hiawatha line and has judged it a success. I think the public's fairly firm in their view of the Hiawatha line as being a successful operation. But I think they wanted to know, could we build it, could we run it, and would people ride it? And I think we've proven we can build it. I think we're proving we can run it, and I think it'll be shown that people will ride it. Will it be at 106%? I think that that's doubtful, but it'll still be significantly over projections. It is bringing in somewhat more revenue than we anticipated. As you know, Hennepin County pays 50% of the operating costs of the line, and we pay 50% of the operating costs of the line, and we anticipate maintaining that relationship on a go-forward basis.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grothel.
Now, you stated that the revenue is higher than was originally budgeted. Do you have some specific numbers? And then how about on the expenditure sides? Are those in line with what you were expecting?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grothel, it is my understanding, and Brian, if I misstate this, let me know, that we're about $500,000 over in the revenue. And I think the expenses are not immeasurably over at all. Is that?
Okay.
Representative Garofalo, one more?
This is the final one. I have to warn you, I could probably keep you here for an hour. Just, I'm new here, so I'm still learning a lot of this. Earlier in the study, you mentioned the subsidy per capita based on cities of comparable size of us. Do you know just a good place where I can go to research to find out if there's a correlation between the subsidy per capita and congestion? In other words, you know, we saw that graph listing like Seattle with the, you know, I think three or four times what our per capita subsidy rate is. Is their congestion markedly better? Same thing with Portland, Pittsburgh, or Denver? Any study or maybe direct to someone on your staff perhaps to get that information from you?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Groffo, I wonder if we could get back to you on that. I don't know of one, but I'll make a note, or ask Good if he would make a note to get back to you on that. I do want to, if I may, state one thing that I believe, and I continue to say to every group that I speak to, congestion will be worse in this region 5 years from now than it is today. Mm-hmm. I think the question is, can we influence that line? Can we stop the line from growing like this to maybe growing like this? Congestion is a byproduct of a vibrant, growing region and economy. And I think as all of us are engaged in one aspect or another of public policy, the question is, can we slow the growth of traffic congestion? And while those numbers may be there, I think there's a lot of mitigating factors, externalities that impact a congestion that would have to be considered as well. But I think it's a fair question to ask, if you spend more on transit, are you sitting in traffic less? I think that's the question the average person in the public would ask, and it's a very fair one.
Chairman, thank you, Representative Groffo. Chairman Bell, wanting to understand your response, the line you're referring to, are you talking about the more miles driven each day?
Yes.
So your primary objective then is affecting, that would, begging the members' pardon, I don't mean to cut in on the list here, but to that point and wanting to understand your response to Representative Garofalo, my question that I was saving for the end if there was time had to do with you're promoting alternatives to travel in single occupant autos, and to Representative Garofalo's question, maybe the Texas Policy Institute would be a good source. I don't know, but I'm a little puzzled by your response because there seems to be a focus on affecting the daily vehicle miles traveled rather than simply congestion.
No, let me.
I heard you address the daily vehicles miles, miles traveled rather than congestion, but I also heard congestion. I just wanted to get a clarification for that because I don't know if this is what Representative Garofalo's concerns are, but I've long felt the concern that we are not building highways because we want people to ride transit. And I wonder if that's what we're doing to promote people traveling, promote alternatives to traveling in single occupancy vehicles.
Mr. Chair, let me correct myself. When I say slowing the growth of congestion, I inadvertently made a reference to the daily vehicle miles traveled. There is not a direct correlation there. What is clear, and we don't have a graph of this, when I talked about the number of hours people are stuck in traffic and the like, it would be more to impact that we would like to, kind of like a laser beam, identify where congestion is in the 7-county metropolitan area and provide some relief for that, both by virtue of construction of roads where it makes sense. And I think in many cases it does make sense to expand our road network. I'm a big fan and a big supporter of that. There are some places where expanding our road network is going to be very difficult or unreasonably expensive. The best example I can perhaps give for that is the trip I take every day. I live in South Minneapolis and I work in St. Paul, and so I go on 94 every day. Expanding 94 either out or up would be very, very, very expensive. To me, that if you're going to get congestion mitigation that has any hope of impacting 94, it will not be directly on 94, which is one of the reasons why I'm a supporter of the central corridor. But it's important that I, as the person that has primary responsibility for our transit operations, not overpromise, because I think if there is anything done on the central corridor, there still will be congestion on 94, and it probably still will be getting worse. It just won't be getting worse as quickly as it would were there not an alternative. That's what I think we can realistically hope to provide.
Thank you for the clarification, and I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's a fair question.
It is a fair question. I have elected officials on record apologizing for needing congestion to get people on transit.
Yeah.
Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Chair Bell and Mr. Shetman. I wanted to talk about the livable communities part of your presentation a little bit. Can you tell me in that number of how much you're getting, I are you counting the livable communities revenues in property tax in your pie chart, or are you counting that in state revenues? Where are you counting the money that comes in for livable communities?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanchesky, I'm not quite sure I understand your question with the revenues that come in from the livable communities.
Well, maybe this will help you. For example,
Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fiscal disparities pool helps fund livable communities, which is a local tax, I guess, supposedly levied across the metro, but it's actually just a few communities who pay it. When you're looking at where the money is coming in for those grant programs, it's coming from the communities that are paying into that formula. Do you count that as a state revenue, other, or a property? Where is that?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanchesky, it's shown in our property tax.
Representative
Lanchesky.
Chairman Olson, if I may, can you just tell me, just as a percentage, roughly the full revenue bucket that goes to livable communities, how much of it is coming from fiscal disparities? Do you know? Isn't it small?
Chairman Bell.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Lanchesky, I'm told it is $5 million. It's tax-based.
So that's it.
Where is it? It's the tax-based revitalization. That's the account that cleans up polluted land. That's where our money from fiscal disparities underwrites that portion of our livable communities grant-making program.
May I just ask, at a different time that you could provide me with separately, not to waste the committee's time, could I see, as representing one of the communities that pays for that, where exactly which communities are receiving those dollars? Sometimes I get a word.
Sure.
Thank
Very
you.
Clear.
Thank you.
We'll make a note of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first, because this committee spent so much time assisting me with getting a transit hub in Brooklyn Center, I want to say that one of the Metropolitan Council's accomplishments in 2004 was breaking ground, building a transit hub in Brooklyn Center. We are the second busiest transit hub in the state, and after a 10-year process, it is completed, and it opened the same day the light rail did. So, thank you. The second thing I wanted to ask was about your transit ridership chart. And you mentioned the strike years, and then you went on to say that in 2005 you gave a projected number. I don't remember what it was. But my question is, for the strike year as well as that projection, does the increase in the light rail ridership, are those numbers part of those transit numbers? Because prior to that, you didn't have light rail. And so is the decline in transit ridership on the buses actually dramatically different than what we'd seen previously?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a very good point. My understanding is that the numbers we have projected for 05, which I think is $71.4 million, does include the light rail numbers. And, of course, the numbers previous to when the light rail was operational, you'll recall we opened it in June of 04, do not include them.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell, you mentioned that there have been 600 citations written on the light rail system. What does the citation consist of, and what does the person who doesn't pay their fare on there have to, what do they get as a write-up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, We have 600 citations. I believe I stated we gave 1,200 warnings. The citation, the cost of a citation is $180.
And are those paid?
Pardon me, Bill.
Are the citations paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know the answer to that. One unfortunate reality is we don't keep the money. That it goes to the jurisdiction that collected it, so we don't get to keep it. So I don't know. I know how many citations, I know how many warnings, but I don't know what the collection of the citations are.
I'd like to know that.
But to be candid with you, I suspect it's rather low. I would suspect. But I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you. our list, we're getting close to the end of the meeting, and our list is growing fast. just make a note of that. Representative Sherrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Bell, of course, we're familiar with each other a little bit because I represent some communities that have gotten a lot of headlines in their relationship with the Metropolitan Council. And so obviously my questions deal with local comprehensive plans. And you say there's a great deal of public input. Could you tell us on the committee how the public input is gathered typically for these comprehensive plans?
Chairman Bell.
I have a follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sherrill, I very much welcome that question, because if there's anything that I have attempted to do at the Met Council, it is a couple of things. I think there needs to be, in my judgment, a balance between a regional perspective to issues of growth and a local perspective to issues of growth. You'll recall when I met with you, I believe, a week ago, I said I take it very seriously when local officials have said to me, in effect, who elected you? You know, how can you in St. Paul come tell me and fill in the blank where, how we should grow and develop? And I think that is a something that doesn't get the back of my hand, that I have to take very, very seriously. I also take our legislative charge very seriously, which is the efficient use of a very, very expensive infrastructure. I am convinced that they can coexist with each other, and one of the ways that they can coexist is to handle our, first of all, to be as sensitive as possible to local concerns. And I would like to think, I guess others would have to judge, that I've bent over backwards to hear, listen, and understand local concerns. But secondly is to listen. And so when we did our framework, we had a number of hearings throughout the community, throughout the seven-county region, soliciting input and advice. I attended all of them. We had a number of, we invited and spent a fair amount of resources, input on our web page and input over the mail as well. And I feel, and then held hearings, so that people could come and testify, to it. So those are the primary ways. We did informational meetings in the communities, we held hearings, and we invited and promoted the ability to input via email and the mail. And we're going through a similar process in our systems plans. And I would like to think that most communities would say that we do listen and understand the issues and problems that they have. There isn't always agreement, but I think we're fairly able to arrive at a middle ground compromise. And I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to do that in the community in your district.
Thank you.
Representative Strong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell. I know that you're having continuing talks with the City Council in Lake Elmo. Will there be a point at which, and I think there needs to be, I think there's some, there, let me ask the question, I guess, instead of make the comment. Will there be a chance for public input in terms of that process before any type of an agreement is finally agreed to? I think it may be in everybody's best interest. I think I would like to alleviate, as I think there's a skepticism among some officials, not only in Lake Elmo, but, you know, in surrounding communities, be it Afton or Baytown Township or West Lakeland Township. I think we need to mend some fences to make sure that there's not paranoia out there of the evil empire taking over their property rights. Will there be any public hearings, any chances for public input, any chances to sell the agreement out in that area?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sherrill, I would respond in two ways. If, and again, I'm very, very hopeful of arriving at an agreement, very hopeful. It will the city council in, I'll be directed, Lake Elmo, will have to debate, do you mean, the issue, and certainly public input would happen there. And so on that side of the ledger that would happen. On the Met Council side, it would go to our community development committee because a comp plan would be submitted, and they would review it in the light of day and have comment, and the full council would review it and debate it, and comment would be allowed there. But I would add one final and most important point. Any comprehensive plan requires public input from the adjacent communities, and so all the adjacent communities would be invited to have input. So I think the short answer is yes, there would be a number of different opportunities for that. And I suspect that I'll go even further and have an opportunity to review that any settlement with some of the adjacent communities and hear any concerns or issues that they have. So, thank you.
Representative Samuelson, we have three people total. We can hang on a few minutes if it's all right with the chairman.
Yes.
But please be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell, just a quick question on Metro Mobility. He mentioned that Metro Mobility is accountable to the Metropolitan Council. In the past few years, there have been some problems with Metro Mobility as far as getting people to basically use the service or getting people to run the service, too. And I'm wondering if that's still an issue, and especially with looking at the demographics nowadays, is there going to be a higher demand for Metro Mobility services?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Samuelson, one of the things that I'm most proud of at the Met Council is our Metro Mobility service. One of the best ways to look at, I think, the question you're asking is our denial rate. How many people call up, and how many of those, what percentage of those do we have to deny because we can't accommodate it, the ride, for any number of reasons. And our denial rate is down around 1%, which is much lower than the problems that existed in Metro Mobility a number of years ago. And I understand really one of the lowest in the nation. The federal government regulates this as well and has standards for us. But the problems that you speak of really predated this council, have largely been resolved, and I think that is reflected in that low denial rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Markwood?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions for Chairman Bell. And first of all, I appreciate your presentation. I've learned a lot today, and I, being a rural member, a lot of this is new, but I appreciate that presentation. On the regional transit system, you talked about some cities that have opted out, suburban opt-out systems. Question one, how do those 12 cities pay then for the transit? And question number two, when you've got the budget, 2005 regional transit budget, where does the 2001 transit takeover by the state, where is that shown into the budget?
Chairman Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Markwort, the opt-outs, their funding essentially comes through the legislature as well. They get a portion of the motor vehicle sales tax, $4 million of the motor vehicle sales tax. I believe they get some state general funds as well. We operate, and this is an important point, while they're independent vendors, we integrate our services with them very closely. So our fare structure, our route structure is really integrated. So they're an independent entity, and some of those 12 operate their own system. Some of them contract with us to operate the system for them. But it is fully integrated in our system, even to the extent where we build park and rides for them. We handle all of the capital acquisition of buses. We handle the capital acquisition of park and rides and the like. So it is separate. They felt that they were not getting adequate service from Metro Transit, and there was the legislature decided to carve out some resources so that they could provide their own services. And over the years, we have, I would say, fully integrated a seamless system that is customer friendly. So they do get some of the MVEF, they do get some general fund dollars. We approve their master plan, and we do all the capital acquisition. And I'm not sure what the second question
is on the 2005 regional transit budget of $309 million. Where does the 2001 state transit takeover, where is that shown in there, and how? Where do those dollars go?
It was in our MVEF.
Chairman Bell.
It's in that part.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I'm terribly sorry. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chairman Bell. If I know it could, yes or no. When I was a younger man, I drove concrete truck at the then NSP power plant, and we poured concrete for that, what we call our own little skyscraper known as a discharge stack. And I had the privilege of being able to stand on the edge of that concrete bucket and ride to the top, 750 feet up, and we could see down to the cities and see the LGS. I'm wondering, can you really see us?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I liked your 30,000 foot view analogy, and with your investment in the North Star Corridor, I'm wondering if you intend to move out our way.
You never know.
Thank you, Chairman Bell. Members, if there's no objection, meeting adjourned.
Thank you.